What's up, bootlickers? I haven't seen y'all since the camp out. I got something to say, right?
Anarchy! Anarchy! I don't even know what that means, but I love it!
Anarchy is, and always has been, the best way and the only morally sensible way to run the world.
Cool. It's not just cool. It's the intersection of life and politics, activism and action.
And there's only one way to get power. Organize. All the workers together. One big union. And the war the IWW wants you to get into is class war. War against the capitalists.
Come on! It's not criminal to be an individual.
It's not criminal to be an individual.
How could you go to a riot without me? You were supposed to be my riot buddy.
I'm escaping to the one place that hasn't been corrupted by capitalism. Space!
I was a victim too. At least my wife was. She had friends who were socialists.
Oh my God.
This is the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, your leftist reading hour for the week. And this first hour and beyond, I'm going to be talking about food issues, consumer side issues, waste, and a bit of things in between. And as I usually start each show episode, usually with a statement of the problem, or as I try to focus on positive what we can be doing, I would like to start with bad news, you know, why we should be doing things differently. So first, the blog is called Return to Now. That is the source of this little piece. Investigation reveals Tyson Foods as number one culprit in largest dead zone on Earth. So quick introduction. A dead zone is usually relating to water of lack of oxygen. It's dead. Everything, nothing can live there. Absolutely nothing, and of course, if an area is dead, so are we. I will start the reading. Nearly 9,000 square miles of ocean along the Gulf Coast is uninhabitable by marine life, loaded with agricultural toxins and devoid of oxygen. It's the largest dead zone in U.S. history, and last summer, it just got bigger. We've known the cause of the ecological dead zone for decades, fertilizer runoff from Big Agro via the Mississippi River and all of its tributaries. But a new investigative report identifies the number one polluter by name, Tyson Foods. The D.C.-based environmental organization Mighty Earth set out to determine which specific companies were most responsible for the, quote, widespread manure and fertilizer pollution contaminating water from the heartland of the Gulf. America's largest meat company, Tyson Foods, stood out for its expansive footprint in all the regions suffering from the worst pollution impacts from industrial, you know, and that's to stress that, industrial meat and feed production. This is, they released this in August. Smithfield was second to Tyson with the highest levels of nitrate contamination, followed by Cargill, Hormel, and JBS. Iowa, where 65% of the state is covered in corn and soy, is suffering the highest concentrations of nitrate pollution in the country, at levels far exceeding the federal standard for safe drinking water. There's a nice map kind of showing the watersheds and how contaminated they are and by what companies. And all links to all stories covered will be in the Facebook feed, the Facebook page. Tyson is also the dominant meat producer in the Ozark Plateau, Arkansas and Missouri, which has the highest phosphorus contamination rates in the country. Additionally, Tyson's top feed suppliers, Cargill and ADM, are behind the bulk of recent natural grassland destruction, converting the last of our endangered prairie to corn and soy fields. Now, soy isn't just for beans and tofu, but is in fact a major food stuff for feeding livestock. Tyson, consistently ranked among the top polluters in America, produces 1 out of every 5 pounds of meat in the U.S. It owns dozens of brands, including Jimmy Dean, Hillshire Farm, Ballpark, and Sara Lee, the illusion of choice, and provides the bulk of meat sold in fast food restaurants like McDonald's. That's where that's coming from. U.S. agriculture creates almost twice as much pollution in the Gulf of Mexico as the BP oil spill every single year. The BP oil spill, if you recall, put in 670,000 metric tons of oil, just dumped it in the Gulf of Mexico. Major environmental disaster. The agro business, big agro, puts twice as much pollution into the Gulf every year. Not only does agriculture pollute the ocean, it pollutes local drinking water, our drinking water, throughout the country. More than 7 million Americans. Why is everyone so sick? Why is everyone so sick? I wonder. Wonder no more, please. More than 7 million Americans are exposed to unhealthy levels of nitrate contamination. 7 million. Unfortunately, the number one contributor to this contamination, agriculture, is largely exempt by federal laws designed to protect drinking water. I wonder how that happened. I wonder how that happened. Americans should not have to choose between producing food and having healthy, clean water, says Mighty Earth Campaign, Lucia von Resrio. Meat companies like Tyson have left a trail of pollution across the country and have a responsibility to their customers and the public to clean it up. But if they'd be sued to do so, they would fight it every step of the way. Let's see. Since the release of the report, they have begun a campaign, Mighty Earth, called Clean It Up Tyson. You can sign a petition, link in the story. So here, let's just wrap up this story with kind of solutions to runoff pollution. Now, this isn't just for big agribusiness, but even your local parking lot. And some landscapers have developed, you know, plans and urban design guides for, you know, making sure that to stop runoff or prevent it in parking lots or fields. What you do is you kind of put an ecological buffer, you know, landscaping, to absorb the runoff, the pollution, before it gets into the watersheds. For agriculture, putting in cover crops, planting farmland with cover crops instead of leaving land bare between cash crops to protect soil from erosion and absorb excess fertilizer, helping to keep the soil healthy. Protecting natural grassland is also paramount, so there is a call to enact a memorandum on prairie laws. Many of the world's largest food companies have adopted policies not to source foods like soy or palm oil from suppliers destroying tropical ecosystems, also known as the rainforest. They should also refuse to purchase feed from companies destroying American prairies. So that's an interesting point about how liberal culture, save the rainforest, save the planet. But when it comes to saving American landscapes, it kind of falls upon local environment activists and national groups like this one reporting this, to actually protect and defend environment and ecosystems that we depend on. Otherwise, we get sick. It's not a quick death, okay? It's not like we die by environmental loss quickly. It's slow. It's via a thousand cuts. Higher cancer rates, higher healthcare spending, and also responsible manure management. The sheer volume of manure, which is just dumped, dumped out of all the crap created by the pig and the cattle farms. And that's just to prevent, like, the pollution from agribusiness. Now, of course, there is the overall goal of ending agribusiness, centralized industrial food production, so harmful to the eco of the world and to ourselves, because it also just creates unhealthy food for us, even when it comes out. You know, you have to depends on antibiotics, giving them to the animals so that they're not creating new superflus. Or at least doing that actually is what creates the superflus. The swine flu, cow pox, you know. It's not good. And a lot's being has to be done, and a lot's spent, and a lot of terrible after effects. But of course, something we can do individually is move away from eating meat themselves. Some schools go to kind of a meatless Monday just to introduce the concept. Maybe you could as well. Now, of course, the number of vegans, vegetarians is slowly increasing. From Collective Evolution, a site with you know, alternative lifestyleism. Has the story, 500 million fewer animals were killed per year since 2007 because people are eating less meat. Alana Kelter reports. And asks the question, have you transitioned to a plant-based diet? Do you make an effort to reduce the amount of animal products you consume? Well, if so, it is thanks to you that 500 million lives have been spared this year, since vegan vegetarians do consider animals, especially semi-conscious, emotional mammals like ourselves, to be lives. I mean, do you eat your pets? What separates pets from cattle? It's mostly just the scale of it, even though we do have millions of cats and dogs. But, you know, we eat billions of pigs and cattle, and I've done my part by not buying any of it for myself. It has become clear that everyone is not going to stop eating meat anytime soon, but as more and more awareness has been made towards the treatment of animals and about the health effects of a conventional diet, industrial diet, the environmental factors that come from eating too much meat, more people are starting to at least consider the option. Because the effect of that dead zone, and sorry, it showed a map that I didn't describe, which was all of the coast of Louisiana and neighboring states is this dead zone. So everyone who lives on that coast lives adjacent to it. And that's slowly killing them, all right? And it's slowly killing people who live along all of the Mississippi tributaries. You're directly, or rather, indirectly, harming people. So, not to paint a complete guilt trip here, but just to point it out, to be conscious of it. Meat consumption has been steadily on the decline since 2007. In fact, it has dropped 10% per capita, according to stats from the Humane Society. That year, the U.S. raised and slaughtered 9.5 billion. So 9.5 billion was the 2007 figure. And as of 14, that number fell 400 million. Okay, yeah, so it's been declining since 2014. Oh, I see. So the measurement is between 07 and 014. So between those 7 years, about 500 million, so just 500 million less. So from 10 billion to 9.5 billion. So it's a sizable dent. You know, it's a 20th from zero. Let's see, the number continues to drop and is really 500 million lives spared in a matter of only 10 years is quite impressive. If the number of animals being mass-produced and slaughtered for consumption continued to drop every 10 years, it wouldn't take long before no animal would have to suffer any longer. And especially since changes like these are nonlinear, meaning that 1/20th less meat consumed in the last 10 years would then become a 10th and then a 5th every 10 years. It wouldn't just be 3/20ths. But is it because more people are moving towards a plant-based diet? You know, are the numbers of vegans and vegetarians increasing? Not necessarily, says this writer. Not necessarily. As more and more people are becoming aware of the benefits of a plant-based diet, they are making more ethical and conscious decisions. This doesn't automatically mean going vegan, but people are choosing to eat less meat. This is certainly becoming obvious by the increasing number of vegetarian and vegan restaurants that seem to be opening up. In past decades, we have also seen a large variety of plant-based alternatives usually in your frozen aisle. My favorite's Morningstar, and there's another type. But put the traditional veggie burger to shame. There are many realistic and surprisingly tasty alternatives, and people seem to be more open-minded to giving these a chance. Perhaps because subconsciously they know that it might be time to make a shift. Many athletes are going vegan and swear by this type of lifestyle for achieving optimal results. We are even seeing many doctors adopting this outlook as well. So overall, times are changing, as they always are. This serves as a powerful reminder that with enough awareness, and especially with the help of the internet, things can and will change. If someone is choosing to remain ignorant, they won't. But the internet has made this difficult. Nobody wants to see animals suffer, and I'm sure that most sane people on the planet would prefer if no animal ever had to suffer again. When we realize how much of an impact we ourselves can make, it helps us to make more ethical decisions. Never forget that small acts of kindness multiplied by millions will transform the world. I believe that this is what has caused the dramatic decline in the amount of animals being slaughtered. We can all do our part to actively create this type of world. And what can you do? And ask what you can do to reduce your impact. I just attended a vegan chili cook-off. Everything was pretty good. I had my favorites, of course. I think I lost the vote as far as what everyone else chose as their favorite. Merely a matter of taste. I picked a more sweeter one. Someone used either Vidalia onions or actually put sugar in it. So I enjoyed that. Enjoyed a lot of the chili. The darker, the spicier. And I love that, too. And it was 120 people came to this thing. So a success of social media use. Mostly because the Dave Gunn, who I've had on this show, has been quite a whiz at doing those social events that people actually like going to and not having meetings to plan them and stuff and not needing a lot of planning to kind of get it done, but just kind of coordinate. Cheers to him. Hopefully he doesn't burn out. I will aid him in that effort at a time going forward. Another point I can make overall is, without reading the entire article, but this is from The Guardian, and it's called Food Apartheid, the Root of the Problem of America's Groceries. Now, the title in this case, for me, is the story, where instead of using the term food desert, which is pretty popular, and maybe if you haven't heard of it, food desert just refers to usually a poor neighborhood where there is a lack of food options. There's no mainstream grocery store. There's maybe just bodegas. And usually the efforts to solve a food desert is by inserting a farmer's market there. Sometimes residents will actually want to bring some grocery store chain in, but they don't usually take them up on the offer because, oh, these are just poor customers, they're not going to buy enough. But otherwise, it's just not worth it, the coverage. They're just usually, poor neighborhoods are on the edges of the city. Oh, we have a store in that urban area. We don't need another. That would be oversaturation. That store wouldn't be worth it. Even if it was a smaller version of the store, in Manhattan, where there's a grocery store on every other block or every third block, they are quite compact. And they have a lot of course, the density is so high that it works. Because I think for a grocery store to really break an even, they need thousands and thousands and thousands of customers. Many hundreds a day. And, yeah. Let's see, another short story. Well, yeah, so the apartheid story, though, kind of, it's more interview, and I don't really like reading full interviews. Especially when most of it is kind of her... I'll relate, though, that is an interview with Karen Washington, a food justice advocate who started Black Urban Growers. And so she, and it's mostly about her experience going around in the food justice national circuit and just commenting on how white it is and how it lacks diversity, partly on purpose, not more subconsciously than consciously. Meaning it's not like anyone actively saying we don't want black people around, but it's just the way they look at the problem. And she uses the example of calling things or poor neighborhoods food deserts, which invokes a desolate lacking of potential, even though deserts are, of course, full of life for the most part, especially in America. But she prefers food apartheid because that does invoke that this is, in fact, a social and civil and racial justice issue, not just one of commercial gaps. That there is a reason that these neighborhoods do not have access to fresh food, that the stores there, that when they do exist, cut corners. She's a grow in the Bronx and basically is the godmother of urban gardening, although, of course, she did not do it alone. But since it has exploded in New York City, and, of course, my neighborhoods around me also have community gardens. It's not enough to feed everybody, but it's a start, and slowly we'll get to the point where I think a lot of nutritional needs are met, and we'll run for the money. And, she also points out on the dynamics of food pantries. She kind of has a middle-class spin to it, or a conservative perspective of not about... like, we need to own it before it's ours. Doesn't have a socialist or leftist perspective. It just dovetails with social justice and left-leaning causes. But I don't think it goes far enough, though. She does critique the charity system and how food justice is seen as charity. Let's see if I can read part of that. So what are the advantages? Oh, yeah. So she just, the interviewer asked about restructuring charity. When you say food pantries, you're talking about people who are poor, standing in line, getting their food as a handout. The organization West Side Campaign Against Hunger has a pantry that has started to rebrand. They set up their organization like a supermarket, so customers are coming and they're shopping like they would at a regular store. That's right. So that's my critique of her critiques, is that she mostly kind of sees everything as a branding problem. Obviously, it's not just branding. It's doing. Doing urban gardening. Owning the lots and the food that you're producing. And having control over how it's distributed. This is really important. I think it's more than just branding. But since she travels in the circles where everyone just, it's all about how people talk about things, because all they're doing, as far as she puts it, is talking. Because these are rich people who talk about black people. And she also calls food deserts an outsider term, which, and I am, as far as the poor neighborhood I live adjacent to, black communities, I am an outsider. And so I'm not going to talk about them and about what they need and whatever. I listen. I try to go to their meetings. You always feeling like an outsider when I do. But it's also because of complete, it's culture clash as well. But I probably should put out a hand. Not that I need to put out a hand. I'm waiting for them to put out a hand. So who acts first, you know? To have people on the show and have certain guests to talk about, I think, bridging this divide and seeing how we can move forward just past rebranding our problems. Or just trying to get back to some golden age where everyone went to church and families stayed together, and so on and so on. But to Leon, on the topic, a short story related to charity and giving out food, but in a more radical sense, or in a radical way. So this is from the Free Thought Project, a site and a phrase with a lot of loaded meanings. But in this case, it's I guess, from a anarcho-libertarian viewpoint. The title is, "Since feeding the homeless is now illegal in certain places and states, a group carrying AR-15s to give out food, and it worked. A large group of well-armed Good Samaritans took to the streets this week to openly break a bad law and help the homeless and those less fortunate." By Matt Argerist, December 16th. Of 2017. So the story is long older than I thought it was. So so this is probably when it was in 2017 that a lot of these laws were passed. Cities like Orlando, mostly in Florida and the South, where it's made a crime to hand out food to the homeless. So even to do that charity release valve type activities, not true justice of distributing power, but just simply stuff. Even that is too much. But this story takes place in Dallas, Texas. Starting to read, "Feeding and clothing the homeless in the land of the free has now become a revolutionary act. Luckily, however, there is still good people willing to carry out that act." So this story has kind of the tone of the right, kind of a right-leaning libertarian. December 2014, Dallas City Council enacted Ordinance 29-59-5, which makes it illegal to serve food to the homeless without jumping through a statist myriad of bureaucratic hoops, including a fee, training classes, and written notices. "One should not need to file multiple forms and pay a fee to obtain a permit to give food to those in need who are willingly ready to accept it. The folks at Don't Comply know this." Don't Comply is the name of the group, an aptly named organization. Dozens of volunteers from children and adults alike took to the streets of Dallas, handing out food, sleeping bags, clothing, and tents to the less fortunate. Never probably asking why they are homeless. As Don't Comply has reported on numerous occasions, oftentimes police will swoop in and shut down those who would dare defy the authority of the state and conduct charity without a permit. However, most organizations aren't like Don't Comply. As they took to the streets this week, many of the members of the organization open carry their weapons, something that I guess in Texas many more have. "This was done not as an act of intimidation, but merely to assert rights and was well to protect them. I think this helps that Texas is a open carry state. Yeah. Otherwise, you'd need a permit to open carry. But since gun laws are loose, but charity laws aren't. Interesting dynamic in Texas. They were never stopped and never attempted to intervene, although police drove by fairly often. A statement by them, "We are not complying with a bad law today," Schwartz said, the PR director for them. Echoing the sentiment from all of those in attendance this year, eventually the city of Dallas believes that it's wrong, it's bad, and unlawful for us to feed more than a certain number of people at a time. But during Christmas, we want to show love to our community and give these people a chance to survive, whether it be with blankets and coats or giving them a holiday party like we did today, where we had all kinds of cookies and a full meal. Dubbed Feed the Need 5, this was the fifth year in a row the group has conducted such an event. Threefold Project reports on length of the war on the homeless as well as the war on those who want to help them. It's relentless. Just last month during Thanksgiving, a group giving out food in Atlanta was shut down by police because they failed to pay the state permission. On Friday, the blog, reported that a new law in Kansas, which appears to be a trend across the country, that allows the police to fine and even arrest people for not feeding the homeless, but for simply giving them money. Basically anti-busking. Clamping down on the johns of the bus, not the buskers themselves, which of course are prosecuted for loitering and other such laws. I mean, even loitering laws exist to prevent busking and for people to be reminded that they are homeless, and yet there are empty homes. 6 empty homes in America for every homeless person, but they are not allowed in because of other laws. After the Kennewick Police Department threatened the homeless man, in June, a 38-year-old homeless man was attempting to earn some honest money by providing a service of bicycle repair to the residents of Kennewick. When he was threatened with extortion and arrest by local police department, and by the way, that's the framing of this speaker here, that it's extortion and arrest, you know, extortion, you needed to pay a fee to do this for a permit, and arrest will arrest you and charge you if you don't. And so you pay a fee, and if you don't, you'll be fined. So basically extortion either way. That's the phrasing. After the Kennewick Police Department threatened the homeless man and prevented him from making a living, they took to Facebook to shamelessly brag about it. The man was told that while it was illegal for him to fix bicycles, he could certainly beg for money. I'll also tack on, I think a leftist definition of beg is to demand without leverage. Certainly the homeless, the working class, most of us have no leverage in our relationships with politicians, corporations, and with the state. To overcome this, we need to organize and do it together. A group of people has a lot more leverage than one person. Just so as this example of this story, a group of people, armed or not, doing it is a lot harder to arrest and fine than one person. So always do things in numbers. It's a lot safer, no matter what. Okay, so I'm going to shift topics to talking about food waste. No, not waste of food, but food packaging. Now, even I, as the conscious ecophile that I am, that I do not, I want to go zero waste in my life, but I do find it difficult because of basically the only trash that I make is usually packaging related. I think all of it is. So let's see, I compost my food scraps. That's a good bucket full. There's my paper, so that goes in a recycling bin. And there's certain packages, you know, boxes and things that go into other, you know, my single stream recycling bin. Now, recycling has its problems, and I'm going to point out how, or at least reminders that it's a problem. Particularly that the 3 R's, reduce, reuse, recycle, are to be done in that order. Go repeat that again. Reduce, reuse, recycle are to be done in that order. Recycling is the last thing you do. I'll explain how. Let's see. And this is an article from Shareable, not the first of the Shareable piece that I'll be using this episode of the show. So adapted from the latest book, Sharing Cities, Activating Urban Commons, which can be downloaded from Shareable in this article that I will be linking in the Facebook comments. The city council of a city in Italy, Capitatori, adopted its zero waste strategy in 2007. The first article sets out the ambitious goals: achieve a cycling rate of 75% by 2011 and zero waste by 2020. Using what experts call a waste hierarchy. Hierarchies are sometimes useful. Not usually when it comes to power. Capitatori's policymakers identified 11 high-impact tactics to reduce waste. So reducing waste is the first step of the hierarchy. Strategy includes everything from a door-to-door waste collection scheme to pay-as-you-throw waste tariffs. That way you're paying for the amount of trash you're making and not a solid flat fee, regardless of how much trash you make and put out on the curb. Two of the more innovative tactics include tax incentives for small retailers who sell products loose or on tap, and the option of a municipal reuse center. Now, a description of what a reuse center is. Slightly damaged clothes, electronic devices, toys, footwear are more or less repaired and then donated to people or sold at a low price. The center also has held free classes on upcycling techniques from Sewing the Woodwork since 2014. The results have been dramatic, though. According to a case study on Zero Waste Europe's website, the city reduced waste by 40%, close to 40%, by 2012, and achieved that 82% recycling rate by 2013. You know, and this is compared to my city, where, you know, I actually went to the meeting where our waste department put out their goals for the next decade. And their decade is to double the recycling rate from 11% to 20 to 24%. That's their goal. They're chumps. As planned, most of the gains in waste reduction came from focusing on tactics high on the waste hierarchy, like prevention and reuse. This may sound similar to healthcare and other such areas, rather than recycling, which is low on the hierarchy. Now, why is the recycling low? So just go through the quick answer because I'm out of time now. It's high energy to recycle. Recycling goods have to be shipped to distribution points, so it's a lot of energy to ship it and move it around. And it's a lot of energy to reuse or to refashion the materials, melt down the plastic, shred up the paper into new pulp, in which it is less reusable, actually. Certain products are, you know, like when it says it's 10% reusable plastic, reused plastic. Why only 10%? That's because the material does degrade with each, you know, process you put it through. And recycling is 100 processes that all take a little bit of energy. And in some recycling depots, like the one in the hours are long, the workers are mistreated, and there was a recent injury as well. Okay, so I was talking about packaging waste. I think the last frontier, most of our trash, outside of throwing out things wholesale, which should go to some kind of reuse center, or in the case locally, we have a free market where you just collect everyone's quote-unquote trash or just simply unused stuff, which isn't damaged, but simply isn't needed anymore by some individual. And it's basically given to someone else. It's laid out and people can come. It's a store. It's a free market where everything is free. Sometimes you have a free market where, like an actual kind of farmer's market, but you have, say, like a free market table where, like, you know, you can leave items and take items, but also a repair cafe, a table where you have someone who knows how to fix things with some tools, someone with a sewing machine, a portable one if possible, and basically, okay, bring your broken items and we'll repair them so you don't have to throw them away. And this is sometimes, this is called upcycling. So it's not instead of recycling, you're upcycling. Well, upcycling is when you take one thing and make it into something else. Upcycling is the usual way. I remember as a kid and stuff, like, this is how you recycle. And basically, like, you take something like an egg carton or some other item, and instead of throwing away, you make it into something else. So, but here's something higher up in the supply chain. Since a lot of the packaging isn't really up to us, it's kind of a corporate decision what their packaging is made out of. And that's usually a cost issue. But interestingly enough, in the last few years, whether through Trump's trade war with China, or simply because China has become developed enough and basically caught up to us as far as the size of its economy and its growth rate and just how developed they are, they don't, and usually historically in the last decade or so, our recycling industry has been dependent on basically shipping all of the recycling materials, you know, your plastic jugs, your paper boxes, to China to be processed. Which, ton of energy to ship it a continent away, an ocean away. Seems like makes recycling a bit of a waste, right? And that goes for most, if all, electronic recycling. It's extremely toxic to handle that stuff and to kind of break it down. It's dangerous. And, of course, it's up to these hellscape villages in China to do that. And they're... for health reasons and because they actually do care about the people over there, the government is saying, we're going to turn off the flow and stop accepting all these recycling goods from the rest of the world and just focus on our own economy trying to be as net zero and as possible when it comes to energy and resource use. So our American industries are thrown into a tizzy of sorts. An interesting position. I call it interesting. They're probably panicking. But now, they've predicated green capitalism and their greenwashing about, like, we're so sustainable, we care about people, by look how much we recycle. And now they can't do that anymore. It's not cost-effective for them to do it, for their profit margins, of course. And so now they need to do something else. So I find it extremely interesting to read this story from EcoWatch in the plastics section by Lorraine Chow. The world's biggest brands join ambitious new packaging model. Beach cleanups around the world show that the biggest brands are the biggest producers of plastic trash. Facing mounting public pressure to curb their environmental footprint, some of the world's largest food, beverage, and consumer goods companies have partnered with recycling giant TerraCycle. And that should be a clue that there's a recycling giant, and launch an ambitious e-commerce platform to tackle single-use waste. They call it Loop. The program, a modern spin on the classic milkman model, was unveiled this week at the World Economic Forum in Davos. Davos, for those not in the know, is where the globalist elite go to talk about how they're going to keep this hell world system of ours going. What the priorities are, you know, this is the billionaire class and the millionaires and other corporate heads. They meet at the, you know, World Economic Forum in Davos, which is in Switzerland, where all their money is held in the banks, and basically they just kind of talk about, you know, what the future holds and what they're going to do next, and what's the next step on world domination agenda. But one of the things unveiled there, and I'm extremely simplifying what happens there. There's other pieces in reporting. But here's how this Loop system works. Goods like Pantene shampoo, Tropicana orange juice, and Häagen-Dazs ice cream come in more sturdy, reusable glass bottles and stainless steel containers. Instead of throwing away the packaging once you're through with what's in it, drop the empties into a shipping tote and schedule a pickup from your home. The items are then collected, cleaned, refilled, and returned. So basically the goods go back to the, you know, packaging facility, or rather the food facilities. Still pretty wasteful. You know, the loops are large. Let's say the Häagen-Dazs plant is many states away from you. Still not a regional economy. Let's say, you know, always things to complain about for me. The idea is to eliminate packaging waste and to greatly improve the product experience and the convenience in how we shop, says TerraCycle CEO. His name is Tom Skafsky. Through Loop, consumers will be able to responsibly consume products in a specially designed, durable, fully recyclable packaging. So it's still just like it's recycling plus. And there's a picture of the package, of the containers. They are nice, and they're mostly metal. The service will launch in May with products in Paris and New York, in the New York, Jersey, Pennsylvania area, so the New York metropolitan area. Other launch partners include UPS shipping and European retailers Carrefour and Tesco Pick. So this is just a pilot program they're starting with in major cities, metropolitan areas anyway. And then it ends with something I just said. The recycling was once touted as the three R's of preventing waste, because they're all equal. At least they were all pitched as being equal. But recycling is not the answer to our waste problem, and China's ban on foreign recyclables has left many countries, including the U.S., with growing stockpiles of trash. It's clear that we have to think outside our blue recycling bin. We realize that recycling and using recycled content is about trying to do the best you can with the waste, but it's not solving the foundational reason we have waste. We did a lot of reflection on that and realized that the foundational cause of garbage is disposability and single use. I had to reflect on this. I just facepalm. We tried to come up with a way to solve our disposability, but maintain the virtues of disposability, which are convenience and affordability. Affordable for who? Right? The company, basically. And whose convenience? The convenience of the company. I'm not sure putting when you're done with something, washing it and putting it in a bin is inconvenient. I suppose, yes, to many, throwing it in a garbage can and having to take the garbage can out is convenient. But it's the same exact effort, and that's the thing to impose or to explain and maybe nudge a bit to anyone who has a wasteful lifestyle, where, let's say, a family that maybe because of time constraints, so this goes larger than just people's individual habits, of course, but let's say they buy all of their food once a month. And they buy all their foodstuffs and various different food, but of course, because they do it every month, instead of every week, let's say half of it or a quarter of it goes bad before they get the chance to use it. That stuff they bought and they didn't even like get around to using half of it. Or let's say they cook a big meal and they don't keep leftovers. Or they keep leftovers and then nobody in the family eats them. Again, more waste. And it doesn't matter if you vacuum pack it or use your, you know, only seen on TV type of product. Waste is waste, and money down the toilet is money in the trash can, literally in the trash can. And that goes for every step of our consumer society. Now, as a leftist, the major critique is for consumer society as it is. Now, it's still technically my position, but like I used to think that we would need a collectivized economy, you know, socialized economy, to do something like this. This program of basically higher up in the supply chain being able to recycle and coordinate this. And the companies are trying to show us, or at least they're doing it. You know, I guess if you have oligarchy and you only have five companies, if five companies or so decide to do something, or in this case, maybe it's just one major company, food company, but because they have so many brands, you're going to see like a quarter of your grocery store is now, let's say, does this model. It seems like it's a growing trend when it's really just one company acting undemocratically as it always has. So just to point out that, you know, as a socialist, I'm not just going for an ecological future. That's why it's three lefts and my logo is like three flags. There's multiple sides to this. There's a side that is unecological. But let's say even if every corporation was, in fact, not just greenwashing, where they're still using the same amount of resources and damaging the planet and people and exploiting people. I mean, that's the inherent part of capitalism. It exploits. Something has to be exploited. So even if the containers are being reused in a way that is really good, in a way that I thought we needed a collective economy to do that. You know, a Soviet economy, where everything is managed in a centralized way. I thought that was the only way you could kind of have something like this, where that circular economy, where you take something from the store. I mean, you can kind of do it individually, as I mentioned this to someone, like, well, I have all my mason jars, and let's say if we have those stores like that Italian city, where everything's in bulk. Even liquid items come in and self-serve kind of like soda fountains, but let's say it's for shampoo. So you just fill your mason jar or your little squeeze bottle. So you only have your one container. You don't even have to send it back to the company. So you can take the idea further by individualizing it and also kind of take a look at, like, well, these companies are undemocratic. It's still not our decision how to interact with our consumable. There's no power there. We have no leverage in this relationship. We're just kind of waiting on them. Now, of course, they're saying they're reacting to public pressure. So I guess all of those save the planet, forward on climate marches, I guess it's something. It's having some kind of impact. It's, you know, it circles around in their brains. Damn, it's taking too long. So I would say still have to do things on your own. It's up to us and organize with your neighbors or the like-minded in particular is where I'm kind of moving towards. Because with my neighbors, you know, there's cultural differences and it's a lot more work. You know, at least if I do it with people around me who are like-minded, at least it's just at least the resistance. At least resistance. Just a reminder of what you're listening to. I cover topics of interest to me. Basically, these are a bunch of stories I've collected over the last month, I guess, relating to a certain topic and try to tie various things together to paint a bigger picture worldview for you to digest, contemplate, and put into practice in your own life when possible, when appropriate. But to start seeing the opportunities. One such opportunity is fighting for plastic bag bans. So I was talking about in the previous hour, last few stories, about waste in our food system, in our grocery stores, and of course that then goes to our homes and creates a big mess for us and in our environment and at home. One such tactic is to focus on one item, disposable item at a time, plastic bags being the current soft target. Plastic straws, not so useful a target. It was interesting that dynamic where a kid kind of looked into how much, you know, the plastic straw use, and it became a meme, and suddenly everyone in the liberal class just started talking about it. About how, like, we should ban plastic straws and stuff like that. And that has a bit of problems to it. Why straws? But in particular, bags, the urban tumbleweed, sometimes I refer to it as New York State bird. I spot them in trees more than anything else. So here in New York, especially downstate, but anywhere really, plastic bags are inherently toxic as a material, and but infinitely convenient, we are told, we think. I don't consider them very convenient considering the cleanup. Maybe because most people don't clean up litter, but otherwise, or their neighborhood, but if you take a look around, you'll find plastic bags everywhere. And it's very inconvenient. If you see it, it's inconvenient to see them everywhere, the spoiling views and just making everything depressing. You might want to do something about it. The Green Party here in New York kind of advocates for a full ban. In New York City, there was a law put together to reduce plastic bag use, but it was squashed from the state level. Too complicated, they said, for something of that nature. So now we're kind of going for, we might as well just then have a full ban. It's very simple. We just ban plastic bags. Put a fee on other kind of disposable bags that includes paper. And simply, you know, just to get everyone to switch to reusable bags. Totes and what have you. Boxes. Local co-op, you know, they just have a big pile of boxes near the exit. So when you're getting when you're checking out, you can just grab a box. Nothing more convenient than that, I would say. Same with reusable bags. Just have like a circulating pile of totes. You know, when you're done with your tote, bring it back, or, you know, everyone brings totes in. Yeah. Currently, Food Not Bombs, the local anarchist run, we bring out produce all the time, but again, the people that come, sometimes weekly, don't use totes, and they don't bring their own totes. So maybe I have to bring tote bags and give to them so that they'll actually have them, because otherwise we need to have a bag of bags. And by bag, I mean plastic bags. And I'm just tired of having to collect them and bring more out. And people ask, do you have bags? Do you have bags? Sorry, the brand. These are people who are very much less privileged. So anyway, off of that inappropriate tangent, a story from Suffolk County, which has put in not a bag ban, but a bag tax. Bag taxes hurt consumers. We were here from consumer, not consumer advocacy groups, maybe sometimes, but definitely from the producers, they'll say it will hurt consumers. So a nickel fee-free single-use bags, which drew the ire of some shoppers earlier this year, has encouraged customers to bring reusable bags to stores. The title is Single-Use Grocery Bag Numbers Fall 80% in Suffolk, Retail Group says. Now, for those listening abroad or in other parts of the country, Suffolk County is that eastern county on Long Island. So we're just talking about Long Island, Long Island, New York. And this is a reporting by Newsday, the regional newspaper. Jerome Gallagher's purchases, including butter and chocolate chips for his wife's Christmas cookie baking, were placed in four plastic bags at Uncle Giuseppe's Marketplace in Melville on Wednesday. He forgot to bring his reusable bags, but he didn't mind paying the 20 cents for single-use bags. With all that's going on in the world, the wars and things, on a scale of 1 to 10, plastic bags are a minus 1, he says. When Suffolk County law charges consumers for single-use plastic and paper carry-out bags, 5 cents each, went into effect January 1st, it drew the ire of some shoppers who described it as an unwarranted tax. Nearly a year later, the legislation is working as planned, says retailers, which reported a steep decline in the number of single-use bags. A survey of Suffolk's grocery stores that are members of the Food Industry Alliance in New York State showed an 80% decline in the distribution of single-use bags, the first and second quarters in 2018. The Senior Vice President of Government Relations for the Alliance, which is their trade group. Suffolk's bag fee law is intended to increase the utilization of the use of reusables and reduce the number of bags polluting Long Island waterways. Usually with change, it takes a long time to see big results. So I found this result shocking to hear. 80% fewer bag used, says the Democrat of Center Port. Single-use plastic and paper bag use has declined about 40% at Uncle Giuseppe's Marketplace, which has three stores in Suffolk. This year, compared to the same period in 2017, those location sales of usable bags went up, well, it doubled, 100%. We, as a company, use millions of bags during the year. So that's a company with three stores, uses millions of bags. Multiply that, billions, across all chains. So a 40% reduction in those three stores is significant. Most customers at Stu Leonard's, a brand that no one elsewhere in the country will be familiar with, but they're Connecticut-based, has two Long Island stores, and says all their customers are bringing reusables. The Farmingdale store experienced a 42% decline in bag use compared to the previous year. Reduced bag costs have allowed us to increase the number of sale items, benefiting our customers. So I'm going to rephrase that since I rushed through that paragraph. Because fewer bags need to be bought by the store, they're increasing the number of sale items. So if anything, it is a benefit to customers price-wise. There will be more sale items. Now, all stores probably won't do this unless it's a co-op, and then maybe the customers can say, we want more sale items. Let's see. In Nassau County, neighboring Suffolk County off of Long Island, has attempt to create a similar bag fee has been unsuccessful. Nassau legislator Deborah Mule of Freeport sponsored a bag fee bill in May, which stalled. Local Republican presiding officer of their legislature has criticized the proposal as a burden on taxpayers. So, the fee is an effective means of changing public behavior, says an executive director of a citizen campaign for the environment, which is based in Farmingdale, which is like the dead center of Long Island. A tax is unavoidable. The nickel fee is avoidable. Just bring your own bag. And that's particular to fees versus taxes, you know, so the right is calling this a tax, but fees are avoidable. Unless all bags would be fee, have a fee attached. But this is just on disposables. Something that has costs, not at the register, at least it's pennies at the register, but later on, when it's choking our waterways and everyone, and you need groups of volunteers giving their time, their labor, to making sure that our waterways aren't being choked, that our parks are not littered. There's work that needs to be done later. Or you can just bring a reusable bag and avoid that work. Because it's not more work to bring reusables, to stash them in your car or means of transport. It really isn't. Some models you can fold up and put in your pocket. It's still kind of bulky or whatever, but it's like, is that really stopping you? I have to question people's like, and of course it's a matter of habit. If you're not used to doing it, it's a matter of getting used to doing it. I'm going to say it again. I'm going to egg you on. What are you waiting for? Get started. Sooner you start, the easier it'll get. And everyone, it's a win. It's win for everybody. Really. Really. You know, and in fact, the rant I just went on can dovetail with this short piece from Plaid Zebra, which is kind of a mindfulness site. It's about culture. It's definitely from a left-wing perspective, at least it's my interpretation. And it has a little piece titled, "Our Daily Demands and Stresses Have Led to a New Phenomenon Known as Time Famine." So this just dovetails into managing our time as individuals, and how our economic system just sucks it out of us. Whether it's time spent recycling or time spent picking up trash later. Not everyone spends the time doing it, but eventually someone needs to do it. Or else you just live in a hellscape. And that's hopeless cyberpunk dystopia. In the not-so-distant past, aspiring futurists and technological pundits assumed that there would be eventually come to the point when science and tech would forever change our lives, robots and computers would do all the boring work and chores for us, and without any responsibilities would be able to live life more leisurely. But as it turns out, things haven't gone the way that these idealists imagined. Yes, the workforce is increasingly automated. However, the economy has taken some major hits as companies strip low-income, low-education jobs out of the economy. As a result, some individuals work multiple jobs to try to make ends meet, all the while juggling other responsibilities like raising children, maybe going to school themselves, and developing deep relationships. They use the word marriage, but I'm going to say something else. If only someone had gotten around to inventing time machines already, we might be able to make up for lost time. Also, we're constricted to the rate of traveling at 1 second per second. In many countries, the changing economy has given rise to a new psychological phenomenon known as time famine, where people become stressed with the daily demands of their lives. A group of scientists in the United States, Canada, and the Netherlands decided to figure out if there was more to this time famine than met the eye, and if it could be relieved through money. So here's what they did. More than 6,000 adults in these countries were polled on how much money they spent buying time, meaning hiring people to help around the house, could mean ride-sharing, using an Uber, and doing other things that reduced their daily scheduling. The result? Less than a third of individuals bought time each month, probably the third that still qualify as quote-unquote middle class, to have disposable income to release some of this time famine of theirs. And those that did reported greater life satisfaction than others. Part two of the experiment involved a real-world experiment. Part two is the experiment, where participants were asked to spend $30 on a time-saving purchase, like buying a lunch instead of making it, or paying for a cleaning service instead of doing lawn and laundry, or then they were told to spend that windfall of time saved on material goods like clothes, games, or food. At the end of the experiment, both options were measured, and as it turned out, buying time instilled more happiness into the participants than just buying material things. So I think I'll re-explain the experiment. Others were instructed on buying time, and others were spent to spend $30 on things. The people who spent things on saving time ended up being happier, or at least reported being happier, than those that bought things. So this is usually like just to kind of debunk that whole like I need to make a certain income so I can buy vacations and the latest high-end appliances or this or that because that will make me happy and fill the hole in my life that having a full-time job or having three part-time jobs creates. I only prefer to have as much time as possible to myself to develop community and relationships and myself. And my own mental health, than having a lot of stuff, or at least having the ability to pay other people to do things for me. Basically, I can do everything myself. I don't need to buy time because I have all the time I need. So but there are, of course, demands, like say if you are raising children or are developing a deeper relationship, which I currently am not doing, where you do need a certain income. And thus the need for organizing and being cognizant of the need for better wages and more control of jobs, and particularly public control of jobs or community control of work itself, which is a socialist concept. Because that's something that, if you think individuals and capital and markets, then that's not something that can be, it's not something planned, it's not something to decide with others, it's just something to keep in the hands of the few. Because it is something that is planned and controlled, it's just planned by people with very perverse incentives. If you ask them to do better, they say they can't. They're just as much slaves as we are. Slaves to using their time, just as the business owner says, I have no time to worry about how much I'm polluting.
Hello, helicopter, are you here to stay? Bodies rest in motion, fighting night and day. Well, it's kill or be killed, and one day we'll get the best of them. Hello, helicopter, will you be my friend? Will you take me away?
And consume.
lost in motion, fighting night and day. Well, it's kill or be killed, and one day we'll get the best of them. Hello, helicopter, are you listening?
Welcome back to the Three Left Show. Sparking joy everywhere we are broadcast. So I'm going to continue with another shareable article in the vein of talking about controlling work and our destinies. I have, it's called Designing Positive Platforms, A Guide for Governance-Based Approach. The title is Institute for the Future, Report Outlines a Worker-Centered Design for Gig Economy Platform. So a gig economy platform refers to your skill shares, your Uber, your kind of sharing economy type places. And this is a kind of think tank, Institute for the Future, they call themselves, which is putting out, and I read the title of their report, basically, the governance of platforms in a positive way, how to govern, written by Niffin Coco. It seems like every day there's a new gig economy platform. As this new form of temporary work grows, and temporary, precarious work, so do the voices expressing criticism over how these platforms operate and who they prioritize. Over the past few years, we've seen ride-hailing companies like Uber face lawsuit after lawsuit, mistreatment of its workers, mostly because they do not call them workers, and Juno encounter backlash for backtracking from offering 50% equity to drivers as it had initially promised. There's increasing evidence between the rise of gig work and stagnant wages. How can companies design platforms that actually take workers' rights into consideration? Two researchers at the Institute for the Future, a nonprofit think tank based in Palo Alto, Tech Valley, California, have come up with a guidebook of sorts. We wanted to make sure our research would be practical, something that a startup, for example, could read and implement. The report released last year provides case studies from 15 enterprises, include cooperatives, nonprofits, and networks, and identify several principles that can make a positive platform. Co-author Alicia Trempet defined a positive platform as an organization that should offer its contributors the authority to make decisions about their working conditions and the right to organize collectively. The researchers said that our goal was to create a framework that would allow organizations of all kinds to quickly implement their findings. They wanted to use real-world examples to illustrate actionable solutions, rather than theories or untested models, which there are many. Thus, Matarazzo and Trepet, the authors, set guidelines for what kind of organizations they would assess to ensure that they would have real-world applications. So we were set on a strict criteria, they said. We wanted to have organizations that had been around for more than 3 years that we could see as had scale and had a minimum amount of turnover. Whether a platform is positive or not depends mainly on how it is governed. Important point there. In the report, they analyzed three formal aspects of governance. 1, ownership. 2, power. 3, value. These are presented in the report around 5 principles, with examples of one or more organizations that are practicing each principle in an effective way in its governance. So I'm going to point out, any enterprise, any social activity whatsoever, is governed. There is always governance. Question, and something to try to notice in your own lives, is how are things governed? You know, is your social group actually quite autocratic because you're always following one person's lead? Is it more consensus-based? You know, does everyone have to agree, or rather consent to what you're doing? And are you in a group or doing some activity where everyone is not consenting, where someone says, okay, is everyone cool with this? And everyone's silent. And silence is taken as consent, when really maybe a number of people are shifting uncomfortably. Maybe they're not really okay with it. These principles, okay, and the principles are inclusion, participation, autonomy, recognition of the value created, okay, like even as a number, and welfare. So these principles are not meant to be all-encompassing. In fact, they are just a starting point. The writers have identified two other critical components to governance, culture and information, that they plan to finish later this year. They are also working on developing a practical tool that any organization can use. They put it as an open self-assess tool where you can measure the level of collaboration within your organization. It will be linked to different toolboxes with literature, framework, and answers on how you can improve. By breaking down the designing of positive platform into concrete steps and actions, Mazzero and TreePet hope to persuade more startups, co-ops, nonprofits, and community groups like, say, our station here, and even corporations, to integrate positive principles in their governance, potentially transforming the gig economy and the economy at large for the better. So now I'm going to follow with a different Shareable story. Shareable is itself also like a nonprofit think tank. They do conferences, all kinds of weird things for a shareable economy or a sharing economy that isn't directly linked to corporate power like Uber and other startups are. Because there's nothing more exploitative than, say, we created a platform, we developed it over, you know, a year, and for the next 10 years, we're going to collect rent from everyone who uses it. That's exploitative, you know, because, like, we're not going to do any more work, maybe a little upkeep, put out some press releases or whatever, but otherwise, we're not going to really do a lot. We're just going to collect half of what every driver uses. I think there's something unfair about that. So now I'm going to talk about a consumer co-op. Now, not a consumer co-op, but, in this case, it is a co-op, cooperative, but it brings to mind the need for consumer unions. Producer unions, worker unions, have been on the decline since the 50s or 60s, basically when it was kind of made illegal to be an active union member. A lot of activities of unionization were criminalized, and it has only been made harder and harder to organize workers through laws and regulations. So as the corporate sector is deregulated, unions were even more regulated, a shifting of power. So this is about, also a quick story. In Japan, Sekestu Club Cooperative challenges consumerism through sustainable consumption. So there's a need for consumer unions to unionize as the buyers of things, as well as the producers of things. But since production has been gutted in America, and now, you know, production is either in the service sector, which is, you know, temporary, part-time, high turnover, hard to organize, barriers that can be overcome if, say, the goal is to make, say, your service sector burger flipping job the job that you actually want to have permanently, or at least as long as possible. And then the gig economy, precarious economy, which is impossible to unionize unless you have some kind of freelancers union, which I know exists, where a bunch of freelancers then kind of get together to buy health insurance together, say something like that. So as I repeated in the past, Japan has a massive cooperative sector. More than 65 million people in the country of Japan are members of a co-op. According to the Japan Cooperative Alliance, a group representing the sector, while there's a lot of attention on cooperative operated by workers, the Sekestu Club Consumers Co-op Union is an example of a widely successful union that's run by consumers. Since it was founded in 1965, the Sekestu Club has managed to grow tremendously, even though through unsteady economic times. Data from the group shows its extensive reach. It has 340,000 members, spanning 32 co-ops that are active in 21 out of 47 prefectures. That's states or provinces. Another unique aspect of the Sekestu Club is that its members are predominantly female, around 90%. So they're definitely avoiding that pink tax, if you know what that is. Tsukesu Club was formed as a women's organization, says Yukuro Aito, Tsukesu Club's managing director. It is still an organization where women are a primary subject, and it has grown based on women's discussions and actions. At the same time, Aito emphasized that the Tsukesu Club does not recruit or seek just women as members. It is open to all. Although it began with its central focus on women's empowerment, the organization has also taken steps to address environmental issues over the years. The club has formed during Japan's post-war economic expansion, when consumerism was rife and concerns about pollution, food safety, and the environment degradation arose due to rapid growth. Today, although Japan's boom has ended, the country continues to face similar challenges. Aito says the club is committed to providing organic local goods using an ordering system that minimizes waste by keeping track of the demands and needs of members. This is planned economy. Home economics taken to the next level. That's what I'm saying. The cooperative also connects consumers directly with producers. This is the key to their model. From the earliest stages of the club, member consumers and producers have spoken directly with each other, producing consumables with understanding each other's needs. In 2016 alone, the club brought together more than 200,000 members to inspect, exchange information, and collaborate with producers across Japan. To address environmental issues, the cooperative have also launched an energy club to harness wind and solar power. The group has started several other projects. The activities of our members are not only based on food issues, but have spread across to cover other functions that meet the needs of local communities, such as childcare support, nursing, and energy. While Japan's overall population is shrinking, the club's membership is growing. The group reports that it has added 54,000 members since 2015, following the creation of their Food, Energy, and Care Self-Sufficiency Network, through which each member cooperative aims to increase self-sufficiency in three areas that the organization says are central to Japan's future. I would say they're central to ours as well. By promoting the creation of the FEC Self-Sufficiency Network, we are trying to create a society that operates with values different than the dominant market principle, says Aito. In other words, we are aiming to create a society which values solidarity, participation, and the coexistence of people, and one that preserves the dignity and survival of everyone. So if any of that rings a bell to you, sparks joy, as Marie Kondo would put it, I think we need to be creating clubs like these. Stop going to the grocery store one at a time. It takes up so much of our time. Imagine coming together as a group and putting in an order from food companies directly. As, say, a restaurant does, or a farmer does for equipment, as any business does. But get together with your neighbors or with the like-minded to take this on as a project. It seemed like a time investment. Oh, I don't have time to organize with other people to go to meetings and plan this stuff. But just think about all the time you could be saving in the long run. The time going to the store and figuring out what you're going to buy and how you're going to clip the coupons to save. There's nothing more depressing to me than seeing scores and scores of boomer women cutting coupons and spending hours of their life every weekend cutting coupons to save $20 to $30. Now imagine if they actually got together and demanded or organized a way of doing that these Japanese women did. And they started in the 60s, so it's, of course, it's massive now. But it starts with the one club. It starts with pointing out in the world, you. Starts with me. I need to be working on something like this. It inspires me to hear about stuff like this. And it's in Japan, and it's in the things like this across the world. It's America that stands out in its exceptionalism, that we don't need this stuff. We have personal responsibility to clip coupons and waste our time as individuals. So in the last section here, I will quickly, if I can, go through two stories that relate to education policy, but with the same framing and context that I'm talking about consumption and sometimes production. But mostly, all the show, I've been looking at the consumer side. And now the consumption of education or schooling, which is a different part of it. Because again, as our market and neoliberalism system we have is teaching education to us as a good, as a service that you buy, and we're all basically indebted to it now, at least everyone my age group is. So now the story is from Kalamazoo schools report zero expulsions after paradigm shift to restorative discipline. So this is not so much about the teaching of education, though the second story is about that. This is more about moving away from punishment models of dealing with behavior problems to restorative side. It's good that, say, some counties, DA offices, like here in Albany, we have a restorative justice program where minor offenses go to restorative process instead of just being given a blanket amount of community service or even jail time or fines, especially fines, and avoiding that by actually moving towards real accountability, especially when the crime has no explicit victim. Now, in schools, so too, you know, there is no some usually not an explicit victim. You make noise in class. I think everyone in the classroom is a victim, so to speak, or affected. So let's move through what they've done in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Kalamazoo is outside of the Detroit area. A major shift in discipline practices at Kalamazoo Public Schools has staff coaching students toward resolution rather than issuing punishments and moving on. As a result, the already decreasing number of district-wide expulsions, meaning, you know, expelling, dropped to zero in last school year. The decrease in expulsions over the last decade is the direct result of the direct district's use of restorative practices, the staff told the Board of Education last Thursday, January 25th. This is very recent. Director of Student Services, Saunders, Director of Special Ed, gave a report to the school board. Restorative practices like daily class meetings, conflict resolution meetings, allow students to remain in school and learn resolution skills instead of learning to fight with words and fists. Bergen said students learn to resolve differences, or rather the coping mechanisms of keeping your emotions on the inside and then becoming traumatized later. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Students learn to resolve differences while considering the perspective of others using skills like peer mediation, peace circles. This is all Restorative Justice 101. We're trying to give them a skill that will serve them as adults. Perhaps the purpose of education. Under former disciplinary practices, teachers and administrators doled out consequences to students who misbehaved and everyone moved forward. But that model does not correct underlying issues, and of course everyone doesn't move forward. Those expelled are left behind, obviously. No child left behind, indeed. There has to be a restorative conversation, she said. There has to be a way to help that young person feel like they are accepted, valued, and loved. Though the number of suspensions has stayed consistent over the years, the number of expulsions and exclusions have decreased. Exclusions are suspensions longer than 10 days. From the 2010-11 school year through 13-14 school year, the district averaged 66, so it just goes through the numbers of how it declined. Board member Tandy Moore questioned the results of the report, which said they sound like a positive thing, quote-unquote, on the surface. So here's a naysayer. I do have to wonder, though, how this is actually impacting our school culture. If this is actually making an impact within our school buildings, while this sounds positive, the experience of our teachers and students, our staff, and the reflection of our school climate doesn't reflect that so well. Now, she's not totally wrong, but I simply point out that in this article there are some moments where it's pointing out that this isn't really solving all the problems. there's still suspensions and there's still misbehavior, you know, ruckus causing and whatever. I'll point out that this is because, as some of the school board members kind of use the phrasing of schooling, that schools are about training workers, training people to be obedient, training, you know, and of course there's all kinds of rhetoric, homeschool movement, general alternative culture in general. Schools are just brainwashing machines and so on and so forth. Do I have to repeat that? Some of it's common culture at this point. Practically pop culture, you know, brick in the wall and so on. And if our schools can get beyond that, you know, teach to the test, grades, make everything a competition, bribe students. These are the kind of practices, you know, make a ranking list. Let's make half the students feel like, crap. You know, we have to go away from all of that. You know, it's not, and this is something I haven't said it yet this episode, but hopefully I say it every episode. You can't cross a river with half a bridge. And in this case, restorative practices are totally necessary for a just world. Okay? Not just in schools, but for all of society. You know, when there's a call to abolish prisons or reduce the power of police, it's about getting away from punishing, which doesn't, people don't learn anything from being punished, except fear for whoever is doing the punishing. And the argument from punishers is that, fear is a great teacher. We just need people to be afraid all the time. Or if people, you know, commit a crime, they need to be afraid. They're not afraid enough. I think that's sick and wrong. Restorative practice is where everyone, it's true justice. Everyone actually gets what they need, emotionally speaking. And the problem, the underlying cause of the crime is solved. Now, if we're talking about misbehavior in school, that kind of crime, because there are things that are criminalized that maybe don't need to be criminalized. But let's say all the rules in schools are, in fact, sensible. People shouldn't be as loud as they want to be and whatever. And you need to ask the question, why? Why are they loud? Why is there this misbehavior? And, of course, it's like, well, some students are malnourished. Some students have terrible home lives, and they carry traumas from as early as toddlerhood. You know, so many things to list. So I know I really got away from reading this, but they mentioned that they've added 3 social workers to the school district staff. Very positive. But like my own school district, they're floating. They're not assigned to individual buildings. They have to travel between buildings. They probably spend half the day traveling, going from place to place. Spending maybe a few hours at each school building when they should be available all the time to actually get to everyone or to get to as many as possible. It's a difficult job, says another board member. Very many of our young people come to school probably not in the right state of mind for schooling. Now, I want to point out the difference, a rhetorical difference between schooling and education. Schooling is about training. And as such, historically, it is relied on dog training tactics that I just kind of listed off. Education is about growth. And so a hot topic in education circles is having a growth mindset or a growth-oriented approach. And this involves giving students a bit of freedom and those principles that I listed off when it comes to developing co-ops and nonprofits that are also functioning better, to have workers to have autonomy, to encourage and have the structure for participation. You know, school government, classic example. School government isn't very participatory. At most, you have a council of a few people and you have an election once a year, just like our own democracy, which cannot be called that, by the way. Republic, whatever. But voting once a year, not really participation. Some municipalities, like my own, kind of try to follow this up by having lots of public meetings. But then when, you know, your input doesn't feel like it's valuable And that's why that word value came up in that other list as well. Then it's like, well, what's the point? You know, I'm just going to check out. I'm not valued here. It's like, I'm not really, you're asking me to participate, but you're really just trying to placate me. You're trying to buy me off and just say, look, it's basically throwaway support. Just to say that you asked for participation when really, as far as some local and national decisions are concerned, the decision's already made. We already made a deal with the capitalist, the richest person around. That's who makes the decisions. It's a capitalist system. Capitalists are in charge. That is the definition of capitalism, okay? We can hem and haw about markets and monetary trade and all that and a bunch of wonky stuff. But at the end of the day, capitalism is ruled by capitalists. An improvement over rule by kings and feudal lords, for sure. But we could do better. We could have rule by workers or rule by consumers. A market certainly isn't that. And a school is certainly not governed by the students or the staff. They can be. That's what free and monastery schools are about and doing. But currently, they're governed by principals, like solemn single individuals, and boards that are elected, but mainly elected by taxpayers, the people who are paying into it, and their desires. And sometimes they don't desire a very effective, they desire a school system just effective enough to prevent riots. You know, they care so much and yet they want to fund it so little. Just to point out that contradiction. As there are all contradictions between collective needs and individual needs. The leftist project, and the project that I'm, you know, trying to communicate, is to break down the relationships between collective and individual needs that are only contradictory so long as they are separate, considered separate. Students are dealing with heavy issues, and schools have become more than a classroom. Schools provide stable meals. They make children feel safe and give supports that they may not be receiving elsewhere. This is particularly because the public schools have not been completely eliminated from civil society. Many other things have. And this goes into kind of a final point that I'll bring episode, that as we are ruled by capitalists with their priorities of retaining the wealth they have and creating more of it for some reason. Whatever they don't, and here's something, just a lens to interpret the day's events, the week's events, you know, whatever Trump's saying or doing, or whatever bad news you encounter, or even good news, perceived good news you encounter. Ask the question, is this something the capitalists need? And you'll find that when it comes to austerity, the process since the recession, let's say it's the total disinvestment of poor black neighborhoods or rural counties that are majority white and voted for Trump. They have been abandoned. They are sacrifice zones, like the Gulf mentioned earlier. Capitalists don't need marine life off the coast of Louisiana. A lot of people along the coast who live there do. They don't need to live in a dead zone. They shouldn't. They'll die themselves. But capitalists don't need that. They don't need, eventually, public schools. At one time, they did. They needed a mass educated workforce. Now they just need some people to be educated. So, they'll move to private schools, charter schools, educate just enough hardcore, dedicated, incentivized students to put into their corporate pipeline. Everyone else, unneeded. They can join the gig economy, do what they can, hustle to survive. But otherwise, the mass economy doesn't need them. It doesn't need the rural counties of New York. It doesn't need the prairies of North Dakota. Eventually it will not need our empire. It will have its own private armies as it's transitioning to do that. Eventually it will not need, you know, once the, and this is hypothetical now, but once the Hyperloop is built, the capitalists won't need the highways. Everything will be shipped by tube. And then thus the highways will be defunded. Now this is the way of history, and history and time is change. So we all have to be less fragile and anticipate these changes, or be in a way in which change is no longer scary and harmful, but something beneficial. And to capitalists, any change done is beneficial to them. Instead, we need to think about how we can make changes that are beneficial to us. So with that, I'll make another clarion call to follow my social media, Three Lefts on Facebook, Twitter, not yet on Instagram. The website, sometimes working, but a full archive of shows can be found at threelefts.news. I have a Patreon account. Please consider giving a regular payment as low as $2.50 to help support this show, to help it grow, and to incentivize me taking this from the hobby level to the serious media production level. For example, putting all of these episodes on YouTube, which I have not currently done yet, but let's see if I'll get around to it. What else can I say? Stay active. Think about what your community is, how to make it stronger, and don't leave anyone out. Don't let ego get in the way of working with others, especially, but obviously don't overexert yourself and know when to say no to someone. So thank you very much. This has been the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, and stay spooky, everybody.